Welcome to this latest edition of the Positive Populist Podcast. And I'm so excited because our guest today is my friend Teslin Figaro. You'll have seen Teslin if you watch The Next Revolution. She's a regular on that show. And she's with me right here. And I'm going to start by asking the same question I ask all my guests. Teslin Figaro, are you a positive populist?
I think I am a positive populist. I guess it depends on how you look at the word, you know, but I do believe as an independent voter, a former Democrat all of my life, that it is important that people continue to push the movement, push it in directions that we have not been before. And so when I think when you describe populism, I would say that I'm very close to that.
So I'm interested. There's so much there that I'd love to talk about. Just sort of an unpack a bit. So you talked about being an independent, talked about being a former Democrat. Tell us a little bit about your political journey.
Well, I think like most, well, I won't say most African-Americans, but growing up in a very conservative household, you know, my grandmother, my grandfather, my mother were self-employed African-Americans, always owned their own business, never dependent upon government assistance for anything.
Where are we now?
In Oklahoma City.
Okay.
Yeah, in Oklahoma City. My entire background is Louisiana. That's what Figaro is. It's Creole. But growing up in Oklahoma City, which is a part of the Bible Belt, a lot of the views that conservatives believe now are very similar to what I grew up in, you know, church every Sunday, church every Wednesday, church every Saturday, you know, church several times a week. Very conservative values, sit on your own bottom type of mentality. You did not borrow, which you could not pay back. Very much a spirit of entrepreneurship. My mother worked 10 different professions. You know, she was a news director's assistant at Channel 4. She was a cosmetologist at night. She sold real estate on the weekend. She sold Herbalife, you know, between jobs. She was a hustler through and through.
Right.
So watching her do that and understanding the value of a dollar, understanding the importance to own your own, to have that independence is when I started working at 10 years old. So really coming from those beliefs, you know, beliefs in God being the foundation and the backbone of all that I do, really, I would say, is the conservative side of my background. But then at the same time, you know, I had my dad's side of the family, which was on a total opposite end of the spectrum. I had an opportunity to see a lot that happened in the streets. You know, when you look at the 1990s growing up, that's when the war on drugs was at its peak. Mass incarcerations, what we're dealing with now, the results of that. So having an opportunity to see a lot of gang activity with cousins of mine and also living in a neighborhood that was a blood territory. So I had cousins who were Crips. I lived around Bloods. So I had a very, when I explain it to people, they don't.
Tell us a bit more about that sounds like a world that a lot of people listening just won't have any experience of.
Well, you know, and they can't see on the radio, but these stitches here, you know, that was from a Crip.
You're pointing just
to my
below
face.
Your eye.
Yeah, just below my eye. Stitches here on my arm, a blood. I mean, you know, I don't get a chance to talk about that on television because we never really talk about me. But that was the upbringing that I came from.
But what does that mean, the stitches? Well, I mean, how did you get? What
Well, these stitches came because I wouldn't dance with a guy at a teenage club, and he asked me, could I dance? And I said no. So I was 16, 17 at the time, and he was a Crip, and he hit me in my face.
Hit you?
Yeah, hit me in my face. So that's where these stitches were over, I guess, 25, 30 years ago. Yeah. So those were the type of environments, you know, that I grew up in. I had a real opportunity to see one side of the spectrum on one weekend over my grandmother's house where, you know, everything was about church and we drank out of 4 ounce orange juice glasses. We drank out of jelly jar glasses, you know, truly coming from the Depression. You know, my grandparents, you know, being raised in that environment. And then the next weekend I would go to my dad's side of the family and
so
see totally different.
Your parents not together at
they
this
were divorced.
Point.
Uh-huh.
When did that happen?
Divorced when I was very young, about 3 or 4 years, when I was 3 or 4 years old.
Yeah, same. I had the same kind of experience, yeah.
Yeah, high school sweethearts, you know, grew up in love. And once that divorce, once my brother passed away, and I'm very transparent with my story, so I appreciate you asking. Once my brother passed away, my dad could no longer function, you know, with that. He no longer could function with the loss of my brother and the loss of my mother. and the loss of me. So his entire life was struggled with drugs and alcohol.
What do you mean by the loss?
Sorry, losing it all. Losing his job.
Right.
Losing his wife. You know, losing my brother who passed away as an infant. Losing me.
How old was he?
Or are these 3 months old?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was 3 months old. So my dad. And
that's
just,
really tough.
Yeah, and a lot of people, and that's why, Steve, I always tell people I've been through a lot. You know, I've been through divorce. Yeah. I've been through relocating several different times. I've moved probably at least 12 times, most recently just on last week. And I really thank God for allowing me to keep my mind, because that has broken people, not just people that I talk about in general, but people in my family, you know, that I know. It broke my dad, you know, after losing it all. A lot of people just can't lose it all. They can't go from having, you know, money and having access to things and having their family to having nothing. So he struggled with drugs and alcohol, you know, his entire life. So growing up with that side of
it. So you had this split thing. So sometimes with your mother, you live with your mother.
Right, correct.
And that side of the family, the more conservative, traditional.
Correct.
Background that you described.
Correct.
And then you're on your father's side. It sounded more, that was more
total
of a
opposite. Yeah, total opposite, polar opposites.
Okay.
So that's where I learned.
And politically, that's it sounds like you're saying that pushed you more in a Democrat direction. Is that what
I would say? You know, and a lot with African Americans, we're Democrats because that's just kind of, I won't say what we're told to do, but it's just the natural thing that you do because of the compassion, because a lot of African Americans have compassion for either what we're going through or what our neighbors are going through. And so the liberal mentality has seemed to offer more compassion.
Right.
But it's amazing. Like my grandmother, she'll give the house away to the stranger, or, you know, Habitat for Humanity or Meals on Wheels. But if I were to ask to borrow a dollar, you know, it's not happening at all whatsoever. So right. It's really weird, you know, and those, and I tell all the time, Grandma, you're actually a conservative. You know, you believe in donating, but you don't believe in giving able-bodied people, you know, that can function on their own.
Yeah.
So I thought that what I grew up, I thought it was, I guess, normal until I started explaining my background to people. And that's when they realized, no, that's not really normal to have those set of extremes, you know, to be over a cousin's house and, you know, watching the FBI kick in the door, or, you know, watching the police kick in the door, or watch people go to jail, or watch crack cocaine, or see people getting high and, you know, smoking
that
pipes.
That was all in your
childhood. This was all in my childhood. These were all things that were of the norm to me.
How come you weren't getting sucked into it? If your cousins were getting into trouble and getting into that world, what kept you out of it?
Yeah, I would say to be very authentic, there's two sides to it. Most guys either say, and some women, you know, either when they see the money and they see the opportunity, they say either they're going to sell drugs. For me, I said, you know, I want to date one of those guys. You know, I did say, you know, I remember the day, I'll never forget, one of my cousins came in. And he had a briefcase full of money wrapped up in money bands, and a Ferg on and a Kango on. And I knew at that moment, I was like, okay, yeah, I'm going to get me one. I may not sell the drugs, but I want to date a drug dealer. And that was the mentality.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
That was the mentality at that time, and I did. And so I was really blessed, but I always kept my job. You know, I babysit at 10, 11 years old.
Yeah.
My first babysitting job was Uzi Brown Washington, the first black anchor in Oklahoma City. I worked at Frontier City. I worked at Walmart,
Target.
Totally.
Your first job was what?
Was babysitting for Uzi Brown Washington. She was the first black anchor in Oklahoma City.
Oh, okay. Right,
yeah.
Right.
So I had access to news. I was always looking, you know, I saw myself in that position. So even though I kept my regular jobs and I still worked, I dated hustlers. I really did. I mean, I'm not going to lie about it. And I was just blessed to be sitting in houses where, now looking back, you know, I look at, wow, you know, I was really sitting over here with 10, 15 kilos of cocaine in the house, 16, 17 years old, not realizing I could have got a case, or I could have been killed, or I could have been shot at. And so there's been a few instances, you know, that I could repeat on how I came very close to getting trapped in a system. But I never had the desire to sell drugs, but certainly the money was attractive.
But it's really interesting just the way you're talking about that. It's like clearly a defining characteristic of the world you grew up in, that the drug dealing and so on, and the crime.
And it does bring a sense of independence, of not having to beg for anything. My job was sufficient enough for me. You know, I'll never forget.
What were you doing then?
Well, at the time, I've worked everywhere, Steve. I mean, at that time, I was working at Venture, which is like a Target. Venture, Walmart. I worked at Frontier City, the theme park. I worked at Brahms. I mean, there wasn't a job that every year I was on a different job.
Okay. What sort of age did you, I mean, what was your education? pathway?
Oh, yeah. Well, from you talking about my first job?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, from 10 years old, I was working at Betty's Daycare mm-hmm. at 10. From 11 to 12, I was working at Frontier City, you know, during the summer. That was a theme park. From 15, I was working at Brahms. Mm-hmm. I went to work at Target. I went to work at Venture. My first job at 18 was at the Bank of Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. I've always,
you know. So you're working full time at that point?
Yeah, always. Yeah, always.
So was there any kind of, and how were you at school? What was your, academically? Did that play a part in your life?
Yeah,
I would say
I was average because I was a cheerleader in high school. Mm-hmm. So that was important, you know, to be able to continue to cheer. So keeping a 2.0 was important enough, but academics really wasn't, my strong, those mm-hmm. weren't the things that pulled me in.
Right.
And later on going to community college and then going to college and on and off, it took me over 20 years to get my college degree,
right.
Because of having to move so many times and start a business and start a job and have a baby and get a divorce. I mean, literally, Steve, I would take 3 hours at a time, you know, just to be able to, you know, finish my degree. So I didn't have a chance to just go to school and say, you know, let's just go to school for 4 years. At 18, I had already had my own apartment, never had a co-signer a day in my life. My mother refused to co-sign for a car.
So you're basically working. So I've got, mm-hmm. I kind of go to college. I've got to work. I've got to earn money. I've got
correct,
to earn my
correct.
Living.
And not because I didn't have a child, you know, but both of my best friends had kids at 16. I didn't. So mm-hmm. I didn't have a kid or anything like that. I just always wanted to be independent because my mom was really hard on me in that way. I love my mother, rest in peace, but she was not one to, if you got in it, you needed to figure out how to get mm-hmm. out of it. That's mm-hmm. just the bottom line. So at 18, I'm having my own place. I couldn't just go to college. What was I going to do with my $400 car? So that's what I went and joined the military, my $400 car payment. And I joined the Air Force. I was 18. And I joined the Air Force. Yes, reserves.
Mm-hmm. Where?
In Oklahoma City.
Okay, you're still there. Okay.
Yeah. And then I learned after going to the Air Force Reserves, I still was broke. I was to the Air Force Reserves. I was working at Bank of Oklahoma. I was doing claims at Shoney's restaurant on the weekend, and I still couldn't pay my bills. So I decided to pack up and move to Dallas, Texas. I didn't have a place to stay. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have a dollar in my pocket. I wrecked my car going there, and my mom said, oh, that's a sign, you know, you shouldn't go. I went and got a rental car, and I kept going. I went and bus tables. I met a girl one night, and she said, hey, my husband just walked out on me. You can stay on my couch for $300 a month, and I'll help you get a job at Geico. So I moved in with a complete stranger. Yes, Steve. I moved in with a complete stranger and slept on her couch. She gave me an opportunity at Geico, and that was the first, was just owned by Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
That was the first professional job that I had in 1999 that I didn't have to work two jobs. It was the first job that I had without a college degree. I was in sales, and it was the first time I was able to take care of myself. And Warren Buffett, and I won't say this because I always talk about how great of a company, you know, he owns. That's when I really learned about profit sharing. That year, he gave back 21%. If we saved the company money, he gave it back. And it was all about everyone chipping in and, you know, using
very
old
powerful.
Pencils, very powerful,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Using old pencils, using old folders. And so at the end of the year, that 21% check that I got for the very first time is how I was able to get transportation again because I'd wrecked my car in Dallas, Texas. And that was a real foundation on business and what that meant and how to give and give back. And it's an awesome lesson. It's what I used to start my company over a decade later.
Right. And then during this time, is politics in your world at all or not really?
It's always been in my world, but not from a standpoint of an elected official. I've never been one to be a fan of an elected official or look at them in that way. Politics has always been more from a justice standpoint, you know, from and I don't mean racial justice, mm-hmm. you know, when I say this, just from a justice, you know, right is right and wrong is wrong. You know, I got my first bloody nose in the third grade. You know, Shante Rowland was getting bullied on the bus and I told Ben, you know, today it stops. You know, that was the first bloody nose.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, fifth grade,
Stephanie
driver. Collins, I said, the bullying ends today. In the sixth grade, I got suspended because I told Ms. Harris, people are getting tired of you snatching papers, you know, so every year I can
I
point
remember
to
when I was at school, I remember like I organizing kind of walkouts from my school, you know, because
right.
like I just felt like the teacher had behaved unfairly
that's
to
right.
us, and like, I got hauled in front of the head teacher, like, who are you, some kind of union leader,
that's
you know
right.
what I mean? It's interesting that early thing, but what,
that's right. And but, you know, that's funny because I tell people if people can't go back to the sixth grade and tell a story, then they're made up, it's either in you. or it's on you. This is in me. And in sixth grade, I told Ms. Harris, you know what? The day's over for you snatching papers. And so one day somebody's going to slap you, Ms. Harris, and
that's
I got suspended really for 5 days.
Honestly, that's a really amazing thing you just said, because basically, you just like explained something about myself. I hadn't really thought of that until you mentioned it. But I kept I kept getting in trouble, like with the authorities, with the school, whatever. When I was at school, trying to sort of exactly like you were saying, like that sense of justice.
Yes.
And hating kind of arbitrary authority and sort of stupid rules
that
people just tell you what to do without explaining it. And that was there. I was doing that
always. I've always been in trouble for my mouth.
All right. So I'm just interested in the political journey as well. There's so much to talk about in terms of your personal journey. But we know you now, you know, when we introduce you on the show, it's like former Bernie Sanders staffer. That's how we sort of describe you. So people have a sense of where you are politically and people can relate to that Bernie Sanders campaign 2016 and so on. So how did you get to that? What was that path?
I just think, you know, I always knew I wanted to be an attorney. When Court TV came out, I knew I wanted to be an attorney and be on television at the same time. I just always knew that during the O.J. Simpson trial. So I just always knew that was for me. But I started in politics in Dallas. I had my own television show. At that time, I worked with Commissioner John Wiley Price. I was at the University of North Texas. I had my own show called Unscripted.
Of
Dallas. Dallas, Texas. John Wiley Price.
Right.
He ended up getting in trouble way down the road. But anyway, but I started my own talk show then, you know, in Dallas, and my own PR
firm.
On local TV at the College Station.
Okay.
And then moving to Orlando, Florida with my husband at the time is when I really got involved, you know, in politics on a very deep, you know, level, really speaking up for injustices. I remember it was about the FCAT, you know, the testing at the time, about testing kids. You know, we talk about school and school choice all the time. And so that really kind of sprung an interest to me. And so by sitting on, to make a long story short, sitting on various different boards, Orange County boards in Orlando, on the Metro Plan Board for Transportation, being very involved in the business community, ambassador chairperson for the African-American Chamber of Commerce. That was more the Democratic side, but also on the inaugural committee for the Orlando Regional Chamber of Commerce Young Professional Advisory Committee.
It's absolutely exhausting just listening to you, Tessa. It's absolutely amazing. It's like you've packed, like, I don't know, 50 people's lives.
And people always say, how do you do that? How do you do that by your age? Well, because I've always done more than one thing at one time, and I don't do it long.
All right, let's go back to Florida. So you're down in Florida, you're getting kind of active in kind of, sounds like local politics.
Very active on local politics, working on campaigns, state level, local level, organizing, organized 300 volunteers for the National Urban League Convention for 3 weeks. I was full-time at Robert Half at the time, you know, so I've been a branch manager at Adecco and Robert Half, the first and third largest staffing firm in the world. And I took that model of staffing on profit on how we can do that for on the nonprofit side. So the Urban League happens in 2008, long story short. Mm-hmm. That was the first time McCain and Obama were on the stage together ever. A friend of mine, Dr. McCarthy, needed to organize volunteers. Nobody wanted to show up to volunteer. He asked me to do it. I had 3 weeks to do it to get 300 people in the door.
For an event in the presidential campaign.
Correct. For the National Urban League Convention. That's correct.
Okay.
And this was Senator Barack Obama and Senator McCain. It was the first time they were ever on the stage. And they couldn't find anybody to organize volunteers. So I went out and went around to the churches and went and knocked on every door that I could. And I got 300 volunteers to show up. And through that is when I saw that if I can get them to show up for free, then certainly I could get my own contract on my own. It wasn't good enough to say that I'd been a branch manager, you know, the largest staffing firms in the world, to get your own contract. They want to know that you can move people like that instantly, you know, overnight. And I did. So I took those 300 volunteers. We also did the Tom Joyner family reunion. We did 100 Black Men. We ended up doing about 40,000 hours of volunteer work that year.
For who? For the Urban League?
No, for everyone.
For
any major convention that had come into town, I was kind of like the go-to person.
So you kind of realized that organizing was, you had a talent for it.
Well, I knew.
And then you turned that into a business?
Well, I knew that I had a talent for it because I came from the staffing world.
Right.
And I've always just been an organizer.
So you're starting to, like, be a professional organizer.
Pretty much. I mean, I was using my staffing expertise to get people to come, you know, to come volunteer. But it wasn't just about, and this is what what I always talk about with Democrats, it wasn't just about just volunteer for free. It was about learning job skills. I was teaching them, you know, you can take this and flip this into a job. You can write this as a job description. Let me give you training. You know, it was wasn't about just come be a slave 4 hours for the Urban League. It was about come and learn and let me teach you, show you how you can use that into a skill set. That was the first time that my volunteers had an opportunity to see me stand up for them. You know, mm-hmm. at the Urban League, they wanted my volunteers to go sit. They didn't want them to occupy the same space as everyone else. They said, well, you can just go sit in the green room and watch Barack Obama and McCain speak. And I refused right then and there to Secret Service and said, if my people are good enough to serve, they're good enough to sit. And these are all stories that people can vouch. You know, I was willing to walk off right then and there. I wasn't impressed about Obama or McCain or anybody else. Mm-hmm. I really believed that my volunteers, my allies, were just as important as mm-hmm. everyone else. So I was very known for that, for bringing people to the event, but also making sure they deserve the same respect. So long story short, 3 years later, I took those same 300 volunteers. I started my staffing firm called the Ally Group with those same 300 volunteers. Started on 10/10/2010 with 10 employees.
Right.
And that was the story of how I started my staffing firm.
And then how do you get to Bernie?
How I get to Bernie. I met, I was doing a training in Florida on crisis management. Senator Turner was there.
Nina Turner was there.
That's correct. Yep. And you have trainers to get up and kind of make everybody feel good. And of course, I was the one that got up and, you know, said the truth that everybody there lost and there's no point in us pretending, you know, that we lost. Let's deal with the real issue. And something about
lost what?
At that particular time, we just lost the midterm elections in 2010.
Got it. Okay.
So I guess I spoke truth in a way that she hadn't seen before. And so we began to work with each other, me working with her in a communications capacity, me in Orlando, Florida, her mm-hmm. in Cleveland, Ohio. Mm-hmm. She was doing at that time working at MSNBC, doing a lot of commentary at MSNBC. Mm-hmm. And we just connected. And so when she went to the Bernie Sanders campaign, I followed her. You know, we both believed.
So it sounds like it's very interesting, your sort of journey to that campaign, just as much professional as political.
Mm-hmm,
it was your
mm-hmm.
skills.
Correct.
And your network.
That's exactly what it was.
Right.
Yeah, exactly what it was. That's why there's always a challenge, Steve, when I tell people about the consequences of consciousness. When I'm speaking up, it's not just speaking up. I'm not just speaking to speak. I lose points. You know, I lose contracts. I lose opportunities. Because most candidates, organizations, when they hire operatives, they want to hire you to just do what it is you're supposed to do and shut up. You really can't do both sides. Mm-hmm. You can't be an advocate and be a professional. Mm-hmm. But my advocacy it just can't be silent. And so that's why I've had the struggle that I've had with still trying to stay in business and offering a very clear skill set. I've worked some of the top crisis management campaigns in the last 5 years, the Orlando Pulse shooting, the mm-hmm. Housecloth rape case, the Dallas police shooting. I was the go-to person on writing the speech and arranging the media and all the talking points and moving that throughout the media. But because of me speaking out on Fox News, because mm-hmm. of me speaking out on Fox Radio, that has hurt, you know, a lot of my business opportunities as well.
Because people put you in a box and say, well, she's like now a fox.
It's that. And then also people fear you having you speaking up for what's right and, mm-hmm. and what's wrong. And that includes them as well.
So you've done that a little bit. I mean, did you feel inspired by the Bernie campaign, by Bernie, did you at that time?
I'm going to be honest with you. I was inspired by the anti-establishment. I was inspired that so many people wanted to run for 2016, but just were too chicken to do it. So many people wanted to do something different, but Hillary Clinton told them to sit down. I was a Hillary Clinton supporter, you know, the first time around. Mm-hmm. I didn't like it that she sat out, that she felt like, oh, you know, well, let's just go ahead and let Barack Obama do it. I like people that fight to the end, that put it all on the line no matter what. So that inspired me because it was something different.
And Bernie was saying, we need a change in that anti-establishment feeling you got from him.
Correct, and because he was an independent. But it was never because he was a socialist or that I agree with every single policy that he's had. And people say all the time, well, how can you still work for him? You can work for plenty of people and not agree with everything they say. You know, I have an opportunity to express myself as a voter or to, you know, decide what platform is for me. But at that particular time, particularly with Senator Nina Turner, it was important that somebody shook up the system. And it obviously worked because now they're all following him, you know, yes. on everything that he says. And not to say that that's the right way for America, but it shows that you can shift the dynamic. You can shift the conversation if you're not afraid to have the conversation.
And so what do you think of him now, looking back?
Looking back, I would say that he's a politician, like I've always seen them. You know, a lot of these speeches sound good. But when it really comes down to it, when you really have to leverage, how do you get things done? You have to work with people that you don't agree with. You have to bow down to things that you may not necessarily agree with him working with Hillary Clinton. And I get it. I know it was the politically right thing to do. If I was a consultant, I probably would have advised him otherwise. To do the same thing that he did. But for me, as an advocate, you're either in or you're not. Mm-hmm. And so for me personally, I was disappointed. In a lot of the things that happened, a lot of things that we
saw. In the campaign in 2016.
Yeah, in the campaign.
What kind of things?
Several things. Just what I experienced by working on this campaign, a lack of understanding for racial justice, a lack of understanding. I won't even say understanding because he lived during the civil rights era. So I refuse to play that game of he's just so naive and doesn't understand what's going on. Please, he marched with Martin Luther King. So let's stop that gimmick, you know. So a lot of disappointment on the inner workings on a federal election and how things are not what they always seem to be. And then after the campaign as well, you know, having to go to the Hillary Clinton side when you really didn't want to, and then being forced to do certain things, him not running as an independent, you know, what they did with Senator Turner with the DNC convention, you know, saying she could speak and then at the last minute saying that she couldn't. So just a lot of
sounds
that.
Like, so you're disillusioned with the way the political machine kind of operated.
Yeah, I'm not disillusioned because I know.
You knew.
I don't know if we can cuss, but they're all full of crap. I mean, that's just the bottom line. You know, they always have been and always will be. I just really just believe that, and it's nothing. I have great friends who are elected officials.
You had no illusions in the first
place. No illusions in the first place. That's why you don't see, if you go back and look, you don't see me, oh, Bernie this and Bernie that and this and this and that and taking pictures and selfies every chance I get. They've always been the same to me.
Right.
Every now and then you find people that really have a good heart, but at the end of the day, to be an elected official, there has to be an ego driving you that wants it more than anything. I just believe that, and so you're willing to give it all up. Are you willing to bend on areas that I would never fold on? It's not in me. It's not who I am. People can say, oh, I was on the ballot for like 3 months and I got off immediately. I ran for a House seat and got off immediately. Once people start telling me what I had to do and you got to talk to this person, you got to do this guy, I'm not shucking a job for nobody. I truly believe in being independent. So
yes.
I'm not disillusioned. It's all the same to me. Do good things get done? Yes.
Okay.
By default, yes. Are there good politicians with good heart? Yes. But at the end of the day, they're still politicians. That's just the bottom line.
I think a lot of people will feel like that. But there's a last question, because we could go on all day. We'll do this again. There's a lot more to get into. But just for now, looking at where we are right now, beginning of 2019, we're looking ahead to the 2020 election and so on. Who is there anyone out there, or is there anything that gives you hope in terms of that independent spirit, that spirit of independence and anti-establishment, is the phrase you use, coming back to the whole populist thing? Where do you see that spirit today?
I don't really know that I say I can see that spirit. What I will say is I think that Democrats are finally learning how to be more strategic. You know, it's no mystery to me that all of these candidates are working on a coordinated effort. This is not, you know, everybody just individually, you know, really knowing that they probably don't have a chance in hell. There's a strategic coordinated effort, which Republicans do all the time, especially on the local level, on the state level. So I think they're finally understanding that everybody can't speak to every subgroup, you know, and it's not about identity politics per se, but having different candidates that can challenge each other to understand the importance of competitiveness. That's more of a conservative view. You know, it's important to compete. Everybody shouldn't just get a trophy or a participation trophy. So I like the fact that so many people are running because they were told not to. As far as how those ideas shape up and who would be the best or not the best, we'll just have to see, because right now everybody's on that what I call anybody but Trump, you know, train.
Right.
And usually that fails in time, because then people who actually think they have a shot start getting a taste of that power. And then that's when you see the gloves really come off. So we'll just have to see, you know, as it goes on, who's going to, you know, stay united, who's going to, you know, stay focused on the, like Cory Booker, for example. He already called out in a roundabout way how he was the only one that led the First Step Act. And that was his way of saying, I did it and they did nothing. Now, he didn't say it that way, but in time he will have to. And I'm going to watch to see if he's going to call it like it is, or is he going to continue to worry about his colleagues' feelings. So those are the type of things. Will he challenge Kamala Harris, or will he not challenge Kamala Harris just because she's a black woman? Will Kamala challenge him? Mm-hmm. Will she not challenge him just because he's a black man? Will Cory Booker challenge Senator Warren, or will he not just because she's a woman? Those are the things that we're going to have to see the Democratic Party unfold and see what they're really made of.
Do you see these people as anti-establishment, or do you see them as part of the establishment?
I see them part of the establishment for sure. Yeah, they're definitely part of the establishment for sure. You may hear a lot of those talking points, you know, we don't like big money and we don't like big banks and all of that, because that's just cliche to me, to a lot of them. Just like Howard Schultz said that Senator Warren certainly came and asked him for a donation. I thought that was real slick that he brought that out. So you say you don't want, you know, well, we don't want billionaires to buy the campaign, but you have no problem going and asking a billionaire for a check. Which one is it? You know, so it's a lot of hypocrisy. It takes money to run campaigns. They know, they're full aware. So this evil monster that they create is not one that I think they live by, and I think hypocrisy is going to show. So I'll just remain independent. I do like what Howard Schultz has to say, just because he's scaring the hell out of him, and I think that's always good.
Interesting. All right, great. Well, listen, Tessa, that was such fun.
Yeah, thank you
for having
me. I
think that everything you've said definitely shows you've got that populist spirit inside, and it was just great to hear some of the background to all of that. It was such fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner, for a look at how we can advocate for a cleaner earth while strengthening U.S. energy independence. Available now on FoxNewsPodcast.com.